Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. I am your host, Mark Chakradini, and we are thrilled beyond belief to speak to this supernatural composer, John Ekstrand. He's done music for Morbius. He's done music for All the Old Knives. He's done music for TV shows, trilogies, and one that I'm kind of curious about, Borg McEnroe. So, John, thank you for joining the podcast. How are things in your world?
They're really great. It's Easter, which I don't really celebrate, or I don't think I have the time to it because I'm close to a deadline, but it's, everything is great. And couldn't be better. Spring is starting to come to Stockholm also. So it's really good.
Excellent. Excellent. You know, I learned something interesting about how different cultures celebrate the new year and spring. I work with a good friend who's from Iran, and they celebrate New Year as the beginning of spring, and they celebrate it with different foods and plants, which mean different things. So it's so fascinating how different cultures just, you know, celebrate the New Year.
Yeah.
So, well, you know, it's 6 a.m. here in Dallas time. I feel kind of like a vampire myself.
Yeah. No, it's very heroic of you to go up this early and have an interview. I mean, I hope you had your coffee.
Well, but John, please tell us how you started working with Daniel. I know you've worked with him on Life in the past, but Daniel Espinosa, the director of Morbius, how did this come about?
I mean, we met 25 years ago at film school in Stockholm. He was going like 1 year after me, or one class after me. And he went into the same class as an old friend of mine from college, and that's so we hooked up, but I was a sound designer and sound engineer back then, so that's what I did when I finished film school also. So it wasn't after Daniel went to the Danish film school, so he contacted me for his graduation movie, and then I did the score to that one, and it got quite a lot of attention in Denmark, so then I kind of understood that I could actually write film music. So then it became more and more, basically, and I was still working as a sound engineer, but then Daniel and I, we did our first feature film together, Babylon Disease, Babylon Sjukan in Swedish, super small budget, but that was our first like feature film together, where he directed and me as a composer. And then he did a Danish film directly after that, or directly like 1 year after that. And I did that one too. And then he did Easy Money, Snabba Cash. And I think that was the movie that made us lift off in our careers, and that went so well, and it went so well internationally too, so that opened up the door for Daniel in the States. So then he did Safe House, which he tried to bring me on, but I understand that the studio didn't want to they didn't want to put in a debut director and a debut composer for a movie that big. So and now, when actually looking back at it, I think it was a good thing that I didn't do it, because I don't think I was really ready to do a big movie like that, in sense of, you know, logistics and having a team and everything, and being good at composing or you know, doing a lot of music in a short of time. But then Daniel did Child 44, and then he brought me on to that too, and since then I've been doing all his movies, and now we've done then we did Life, and then we did now Morbius. So we've been on it's 7 films, I think.
Okay, well, geez, you know, that there's a something to be said about the shorthand that's developed over years and the friendship and that. So, you know, Safe House is just about 10 years old right now. You know, you've been doing this, like you said, for about a quarter of a century. How do you feel professionally, creatively, confidence-wise in the past 10 years, especially coming from, you know, sound engineering?
You know? No, but I mean, of course, it's. I mean, I always have this huge imposter kind of syndrome thing always behind me. No, because I
do. Don't worry about it.
I think everybody has it. But I don't know. Sometimes I really, the thing that I'm not classically trained at all in any instrument. So I'm pretty self-taught in most of it. I played the clarinet as a kid, but I kind of quit really early because it wasn't cool. you went into your teens and it's like, why am I playing the clarinet? Why didn't I choose the guitar or something like that? So, but I think it's really what I, and this is going to sound super cliche and so on, but I feel just so grateful to be actually where I am and without, you know, really any education or whatever. I'm just super happy for everything that turns up and how everything is turning up and so on. And I'm just flattered also that people want to work with me and want me to write their music for them. I mean, it's a really privileged job in one way, because it's, you know, you got to do something you love, and writing music to films, which I love movies also. So I'm a huge movie nerd also. So I think it's, no, for me, this is just a dream. But of course, then it's a job. Many times it's a job too, you know, it's a lot of deadlines and it's a lot of people depending on you and that you have to deliver. So I think that is, but I mean, if you were going back when I went to film school with Daniel and telling I would be here right now, I would believe you. I think it is, it's been crazy, you know. And I mean, Sweden is such a small country with 10 million people. So what are the odds actually that we have Ludwig, but which is a huge composer. And he's super talented and super successful. But what are the odds? So I'm just super happy and grateful for being on this fantastic ride.
Well, great. Well, you know, before we dive into your projects, why don't we know just a little bit more about you? You know, you mentioned you're a movie nerd. Do you have a movie that you think is, we like to use the expression guilty pleasure, you know, something that maybe your friends think is absolute garbage, but you love? And what was the first movie you really remember seeing to the point where, like, I feel something on the screen, there's a connection?
No, but if I take the one that really made me connect with something, I think when I saw just the whole, I mean, as a kid, I loved the Star Wars movies and everything like that. And of course, I had all the Star Wars figures and everything and collected those when I was a kid. So I was a huge Star Wars fan. But that was just a sci-fi thing. But when I saw, I think it was my big brother that showed me Blade Runner. When I saw that as a kid, I thought that was just, wow, what a, you know, the world that you were in when you saw it, you know, I thought that was, it was so complete for me in so many ways, I remember. So it's all, that's a movie that's always been following me, I think, because I really, really like that one still. And then what was the first one? Well, the guilty pleasure one. Oof. I don't know. This is a funny thing. I work with, okay, it's not a guilty pleasure, but I work on and I can't remember this movie's name, but I work on with a movie with Lasse Hallström, who did What's Eating Gilbert Grape and Chocolate and so on right now. And the thing is, I was going on a ferry here in Sweden, where it's a long ferry, it takes like 4 hours, and you can see, you know, you sit in your seat and you have like on this, you can see a movie. And it's an old Lasse Hallström movie about a dog and Richard Gere. And I got so emotional watching that during, you know, we were sitting on the ferry and you were really tired, and I started watching it. And I felt like I started crying watching that. And I was just looking around and I was like, is anybody seeing me? And so embarrassed. And I told Lasse that, damn you, Lasse, you made me cry on a ferry in Sweden. And that's, I mean, it's a really cheesy movie. And I said that to Lasse also, but it's so I think that is a guilty pleasure.
Okay, man, that never would have pegged at that one, but I think we all have our something similar.
I haven't seen it since, but and I haven't seen it before either. So it's it was just something that struck me. It's like, God damn it, this
that's poor great,
little
John.
Dog. Poor little dog.
Well, let's go from dogs to bats to vampires. Morbius has a very eclectic score, and what I like about it is that it's very pulse pounding at times. It's got some very nebulous sounding synths that I can't tell if they're strings or synthesizers. So maybe can we start with what you and Daniel thought? Maybe you know the vibe you wanted to go hit going in. And then I guess knowing Daniel for so long, how early did you get involved?
No, but to start with, I got involved, quite early, or at least he told me about the project quite early, but I didn't start writing until, when they started editing, actually, somewhere. Okay. I started to fiddle around but we decided quite early that we wanted to do like a synth heavy pulse driven score, definitely, and of course, and it, I mean, it is in a way it's a superhero film and maybe not like the ordinary superhero film, but it is about a superhero anti-hero, so you really want the drive in it, and the push and everything, and that's also what the studio expects and so on, but I think it's really for me and Daniel, because I am a big synth nerd. I come from electronic music. That's where I grew up listening to a lot. So this is our first score that we actually go like this synthy in a way, which I really enjoyed. It's been too long. So I think the process was just to, make it more than sounding still, and I have the backup of the orchestra, because you want the backup of the orchestra, because especially in a movie like this, you want that bigger than life feeling with the background of the orchestra, and I think synths can do a lot, but that feeling you can only nail with the orchestra, so I think it was really important to have it too. And then we really wanted to make it a dark score and more into the horror side than going into the classic superhero kind of slot, I think.
Which I think that makes sense. And, there's, by virtue of me running the site and being a film music fan for close to four decades, there's times where I hear something and I go, well, I'm reminded of this. I'm not saying it sounds like a copy, but it emulates the vibe, and the things that I guess I'm giving this your work some high praise, is it's reminded me of the scope of something like Batman Begins, but also the energy of M83 and Joseph Trapanese's Oblivion.
Yeah,
because there's a lot of energy to it, which I think is great when you get a film that kind of a DNA to sort of put on.
Yeah. No, and I think it is, of course, I think since I watch so many movies also, and I love movies, so you always get inspired by other movies. I think it is inevitable that you, and you always got to be that, I like that thing as a movie nerd also. So paying homage to different movies while you're actually doing the score, that it is like, okay, this sound can actually be resembled to that. Okay, cool. Let's keep it in, because I think it is a homage and a love for the movies also, and it's so I think it is, everything is happening. It's not that you're sitting and copying a thing, but it's since you've seen these movies so much and loving movies, it lingers in a way. And I think it is, that's just the thing.
Well, I've written a screenplay, and there are so many times that I'm in the middle of it and I'm going, well, I love that scene from a John Carpenter film, or I love the dialogue from this 1940s film. And it just, yeah, if you can, again, yeah, it's not copying, but if you can sort of channel like what that makes you feel, it's great.
Get a little of that little sprinkling, what they have there. I think it is, it's only in the music world. I mean, it is, there is also, you're kind of, narrow down to something that you have to present and do with a movie like this. You know, it is, you know, you can't come with a super art house score to a movie like this, I'm afraid. At least I don't have the balls to do that. I wish I had, but it's I don't think that score would have landed on this movie.
Sure. No. Well, you know, can we break down a couple elements? There's some tracks that really stand out in the score, and I'm curious about both the mindset, both the tooling of it, and just some instruments that I just can't place. I think the Rooftop Fight is my favorite track, but there is a track called Birds of Prey, and there's this thing that sounds like a siren or like a low. Yeah, can you kind of describe what that is and how that plays?
That's the, it's a synth over there. It's called the EMS Synthy. So it's a fantastic synth that it's hand built in England, and it's from like the 70s. Pink Floyd used it on Dark Side of the Moon. So it is it's a really quirky synth. You never get what you're kind of expecting out of it. So it is a little bit of music by accident. And if you're going to go really geeky, like the envelopes are triggering itself, so you can get these kind of alarm sounds. And if you connect that to the pitch, because you have like a pin matrix where you connect everything in the synth, so it's you can really do this kind of alarm sounds. It's really good for space farts and alarm sounds. That's it. And it costs as much as a car. And it's a great synth for just, you know, you switch it on and it just sounds weird.
Could you repeat that? It's good for alarms and what was the first thing you said?
Space farts.
Oh, okay. Yeah, just want to make sure I heard.
No, it's space farts. You know, when it's just this, sounds like a alien space fart. but it's a really nice noise machine. So my wife was really questioning me when I got that one. Because she heard how much it costs. And I don't know what it costs now, but I think I paid $9,000 for it or something like that. And so it's a really expensive space fart.
Okay. galaxial flatulation.
Exactly.
Well, you know, I don't think I need coffee. I think talking to you this early in the morning has got me perked. So thanks. This is
okay. Really great. Okay. No, but that one is really, I think it's the most of the alarm sounds is that one throughout the score, actually. That and there's some made with the Roland System 100 also, which is the old analog, which is a fantastic filter sim. It's really gnarly, so you can really push it. So those two are basically the main like alarm sound throughout the score.
Okay. Well, in a track like A Cure Is Possible, can you tell me the instruments in that? And it's not the same as Birds of Prey, but there's some horns and like really low like pulses or grumbles.
Yeah. I have to freshen my mind. Curious, but that's the bench when they're sitting in the park. Yeah. So that is, I think it's like the Moog one. So that is over there. I think that's the baseline to give that like driving feeling. And then of course it's horns that we recorded in Los Angeles, and then it's strings that we also recorded in Los Angeles. And some perks also, just, you know, rolls and stuff like that for the transition, I think. But that's more, in a way, it's a much more traditional cue. Everything else is a little bit, you know, dirty and pressed and, you know, and it's a little bit distorted and so on. It's a lot of like atonal stuff. That one is pretty, normal.
I gotcha. Well, you know, you mentioned living in Stockholm and then working with these LA musicians. You know, I don't think, even though we're pretty much out of the pandemic, it still feels like we're going to be talking about that for a while. So you've got your studio at home. What was it like working in sort of silo conditions?
No, but that was the hardest part, I think, with the whole project. Not be able to go to LA and, you know, do proper spotting meetings. And also, you know, it's hard for the communication with the editorial department and Daniel, also the director who was in LA. I mean, they are doing all their Skype meetings or Zoom meetings too, because even if they're in LA, you know, they have to have the Zoom meeting. So getting your Zoom meeting is, you know, especially with the time difference, you know, and also knowing that I had to go to LA to record because it was a union film and so on. That was the only option. It was really, really hard to get the working visa because the American embassy here in Stockholm was on a lockdown, so you couldn't get any appointments. Okay, so fine. Then they're like, okay, you can get it in London. Yeah, but I can't travel to London. That's the problem. We were locked out of London. The Swedes, we couldn't go to England. So it was just this. Yeah. So that was really, really frustrating. So I think I got everything in place for like 3 days before leaving for LA for recordings. So the last couple of weeks were really stressful in that sense. I mean, much more just because of the pandemic. And then also the recordings were just, you know, we had to record everything separate with, you know, and a fair amount of spacing in between the players. And especially the brass was just, you know, I think it was, I don't remember how many in feet. I don't know how it is. At least like 8 or 9 feet in between each player. So it turned out great, but I think it took like a good, a good session, 3 hours or something like that, to really get the intonation in between the players, of because they were so distanced and they're so used to sitting close to each other for the intonation. So that was a little bit of experiment, but in the end it went great.
The spacing out musicians, does that hurt or help or just give a different vibe to?
No, but I mean the sound becomes a little bit different. To be honest, I couldn't really tell because this was the first time I was recording in LA too, because I've always been recording in London. So that I didn't know if it was the studio that made that, but I think the sound was great. The problem was for the players because they want to hear the other player that sits next to them.
I see.
So you're so they were so dependent on each other. You could notice that, and you know, as a section, you know, and now when they were spaced out, they couldn't really intonate to each other. So it was a little bit of a problem in the beginning.
Okay.
But we solved it. It was, yeah. And they hadn't been playing, you know. That was a great thing. All the players were so happy because I think we were the first like big studio show. Oh, I think Ghostbusters maybe were before us, but that did record because we recorded the score like 2 years ago. So pandemic and pushing.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, I like the idea, or at least the first of all, sharing some stories behind the scenes is always great to hear. But I'm kind of amazed that it's not just the writing hurdles or the technical hurdles of, you know, juxtaposing live players with electronics. Now you're the logistics of just trying to get these people together in the same room, all like pushing a boulder up a hill.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's snowing and sleeting in the face. So I think that, you know, the music speaks for itself. So thank you for giving some of that. So I do have a question. You know, there's the orphanage track is very, very tender, and then it ends very tensely. And then Superhuman is great. It's got some fantastic electronics, synths and choral work. But when you're working with voices, is it most of the time you use live players, or is there a really good or synth augmentation, I guess?
Yeah, no, but there's some good, really good sampling, especially if you're just going to do like choral stuff when it's not, you know, when it's just pads of voices, then it's a lot of good sampling libraries nowadays. And with a good score mixer, you can really make it sound good. And I'm not a good writer on writing advanced choir things. So it is mostly basic stuff. But for instance, I have a toolbox from earlier recordings with choirs and like effects and screaming voices and whispers that I tend to use a lot on all my scores. But choirs is one of the funniest or coolest things to record because it gives so much when you actually stand there with the choir. I think it is, for me, it's something that I really learned to love and appreciate of recording. So, but on this one, that was a big no from the studio when we wanted to record the choir. They were like, during a pandemic, absolutely not. That's not going to happen. So that was... So what you hear in the choirs is from an old toolbox and sample choirs, actually.
Okay.
I did a Danish movie called Margaret, Queen of the North, like 4 months after we recorded Morbius here in Sweden, where we actually recorded with a choir. But we also had a lot of distancing, but it's a great thing to do.
I'll bring up one parallel. Patrick Doyle, the reason I'm bringing this up is twofold. I actually spoke to him years ago at 4:30 or 5 in the morning while he was in France. And so this is like, oh, this is my second transatlantic early morning. But he's famously known for doing... the Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the first prequel, and so there's a video of him. He couldn't think of this this choral track in the movie, and he couldn't think of like how what was his inspiration for this, and he just simply goes, I got a cookie for you. So there's a video of him working with the choir, and it's just this big moment, but it's like as simple as I got a cookie for you, and it's it's just like, you just don't think about these things until you're on the day or like, a year from now you think, well, I'm going to be working on this project. And just, it's amazing what happens like in the thick of the creative process.
So. Yeah, totally. And also, music by accident and stuff like that is when it's happening to the score. I think that is that's the funny thing. And that's the stuff you remember also from a score, the stuff that stands out. And and also the hurdles with a score is the stuff that you remember, it's not the, that went smooth. You don't remember that. That's not so interesting, it's
there. Exactly. Well, going back to what you said about sound engineering, and, I learned not too long ago, I spoke to Steve Mazzaro, who did, Dune and No Time to Die with Hans Zimmer. And Army of Thieves, and he told me about the term tracking up, or double tracking. So I'd never heard of something like that. But when you come from the world of sound engineering, are there little tricks, little technical tidbits that you like to use on your scores to make them your own, or just things that are, that scores these days need this, and that's what they should teach you in music school?
No, but I mean. Maybe not so much. I mean, there's quite a bit of the like percussions and so on that I record here in the studio on Morbius, for instance. But when I do Scandinavian movies, like the Danish movie I told you about, that's a medieval film. I don't know that much about medieval music, but I bought a couple of old instruments. But then I try to, I just try to play the instruments myself. Even if it sounds really, really bad and so on, I think it gives a genuine tone to it. And you see the picture, how it filters through your brain and how it communicates with your hands and what kind of music comes out. I think it's something happening there. And, of course, I could have brought in a fantastic player of the key harp, which I could have, but I didn't want that because that would have given the right feeling for that score. So I think it is, for me, it's all about giving the old, to record a couple of layers at least, because you can, You know, in the sonic spectrum of the sound, you can, you know, you can feel the stuff that you recorded, you know. And if you have a good mic and a good preamp, and even if you don't, that will give it, you know, that extra personal touch, even if it's just a, you know, recording of an egg, you know, it's if you pan that a little bit slightly differently or pitch it down or whatever, it's going to give a new feeling because nobody really played it exactly like you. So I think it is... I think it's good just to try to record as much stuff as possible yourself and do those small things that you can actually record with live players and not lean too much on sampling libraries and so on, because everybody can get their hands on sampling libraries, you know. Nobody can play not everybody can play really, really crappy key harp, which I can.
That is a skill of Jon Ekstrand, everybody.
It was so funny when I did that score. It's I was sitting here, and, you know, I was like, my God, are they actually paying me to do this? And so it's, yeah. So.
Well, before we wrap this up, can you tell me, I'm a little confused about the Borg McEnroe credit on IMDb. Can you tell us about the work on that? Because
how many are we? We're like 42 composers on that, or what is it? Okay. I think we're four. This is definitely not talking down on somebody, but I'm just going to tell it how it is. I worked with, they asked me from the get-go to write the whole score for it. But then I was doing life, and I really need some time off after life. So I actually turned it down. So they started working with Jonas Struck and Vladislav Delay. The producers called me and later on the director too, because they were worried that they weren't getting what they wanted. Then they called me and asked me if I could do it. And I was doing a score for a TV series called Alex together with a friend and a composer friend that I work with on a couple of projects called Johan Sevedag. And we were in the studio at the same time. And, you know, we had 2 weeks, I think, to work on Borg. It wasn't the whole score. So basically, they wanted us to score the final game, which is half the movie. That was, I think it was like 40 minutes of music they wanted us to write. So, and then I said to them, if we're going to do it this fast, we have to be two. Because you can always, even if we sit in the studio and writing in the same time, we're not splitting up. It's so much, you take so much faster decisions when you're working as two, I think. You're not doubting so much, because then it's like, okay, this is good. You don't have the time to. So that was basically it. And then we did it. And of course, it was a little bit of a, in Sweden we call it dålig stämning. It was a little bit of a bad vibe there for a while. But I mean, I think it was, I don't know. Those things are hard to replace somebody else, because I really get a bad conscience for doing that, because it's I know how hard it can be sometimes, you know. It's you maybe don't come up with the best idea, you know. So but now, I mean, I know Jonas, at least. We met several times after that, and I think it's no hard feelings at all. But it was a little bit of a strange situation, you know. And also we agreed upon of everybody having the credits. So that's why we were four people there. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I'm really happy I saw the movie. I liked it quite a bit, and I liked the Borg theme is just this. It's just calling it tender is the wrong way to put it, but I just love that sort of string, that sort of it kind of a back and forth, almost parallels tennis itself. You know? It's great.
And Jon is the director for that one. He's the one who did All the Old Knives now, that is out on Amazon.
Oh, okay.
Which Rebecca did.
Well, yeah, I've not yet checked that out.
Yeah, that was once again replacing another composer, which was really weird also. So yeah, it's just, so he's the director is followed by replacing composer. And then he calls me the second time. It's like, fuck you. Call me the first time.
Well, Jan, thank you so much for your time. Everyone check out Morbius, and please, why don't you take us out and tell us what you're working on next, if you can, if you have the liberty.
Yeah, I'm working on Lasse Hallström's movie called Hilma, which is a biography pick about a Swedish artist, Hilma af Klint. It's they speak English, but it's about a Swedish character, and it's shot here in Sweden. So that, and I think it's coming out this autumn or something like that. So I'm recording in the beginning of June, and then I'm going to have the summer off, and then I'm going to do another European film called Madame Luna, which is about a fugitive smuggler in Lebanon, which is really interesting story and very dark, which I'm really looking forward to do, because it seems like a really good movie and the script is fantastic. So yeah, that
sounds great. I'm actually very excited to check those out. So good luck on those processes. Hope it's easy peasy, as they say.
Yeah. it never is. That's the thing. You're like, oh, this is smoother.
Well, Jan, thank you so much for your time, and I hope to catch up with you soon. All the best.
Yeah, you too.